boxcar and was sawing at a bar with Ava's gold file. Through everything, the days at Via Tasso and the week at Borgo San Dalmazzo, Ava's file had never been discovered. When the man had asked if anyone had something that might work to cut through the bars, she'd offered it to him. Armand had been at it all day, trading off with a boy of 12 or 13 named Pierre, who was with his mother, a woman named Gabrielle. Gabrielle had soaked her scarf in urine from the bucket in the corner, and when the men weren't sawing, Pierre worked it back and forth over the bar, using the corrosive liquid to weaken the metal where the man had attempted to cut through with the file. Armand braced his feet against the side of the car and pulled, with all his might and strength, against the bar he'd been laboring to weaken.
"It's going to break! I can feel it!" he yelled, triumphant.
With a mighty yank, he bore down, and the bar came free at the top. He grabbed the severed end and hung from it, bending the bar back, creating an opening about a foot wide and a foot tall. He was a very thin man, but he was going to have a difficult time getting through.
"They shoot at the first jumpers,"
Ava heard the man telling the boy who'd helped him all day and all night long.
"So I will go first."
"You can't do this. I am responsible for everyone in this wagon."
The protester was a heavier set man with a bolero perched on his head.
"If you jump, I will be punished. We will be punished."
The man spread his arm to include everyone else, and a woman spoke up from behind him.
"You will die. Someone jumped when we were being shipped to San Dalmazzo. His clothes caught as he was jumping, and he was pulled under. We saw the blood and the strip of fabric hanging from the window when we got off the train."
"We are going to Bergen-Belsen. There is no need to take this risk,"
another man argued. Armand could only shake his head in disgust.
"Bergen-Belsen is a labor camp,"
Armand argued.
"Hard labor. And we have done nothing wrong. You act as if being sent to a work camp is our due."
The voices of protest rose again, urging him to think of others.
"No, I am jumping. I would rather die now than die slowly,"
he shouted. He scrabbled up the side of the car once more, and Ava watched with all the others as he squirmed and wiggled through the small window, trying to get his shoulders to fit. He had just managed to clear his upper body when the sound of shooting commenced. People screamed, and Armand's legs jerked wildly and then went limp. He hung, still wedged in the hole he'd worked so hard to create. Another man pulled him down. A portion of Armand's head was missing, and the rest was covered in blood, obscuring his face entirely. He was dead. One woman began to weep, but most of the passengers lapsed into silence, careful not to look at the man who had risked it all and died for his efforts.
"Where are they shooting from?"
Ava spoke up quietly.
"The Germans. Where are they? We are on a moving train. I don't understand."
As much as they would like their prisoners to believe it, the Germans were not all-powerful. They did not look down from on high, from the heavens, plucking lives from the earth like God. Instead of scaring her, the shooting made her angry.
"They have a lookout, a guard, and a roving spotlight on each end of the train, in the engine and in the caboose. Wait until a light passes over and then push yourself out. Feet first, not head first."
The woman named Gabrielle spoke up.
"So if you can wiggle through the opening quickly enough, you have a better chance."
Ava hoped she was asking the question correctly. She garbled some of her words and put a vowel on the end of everything. She was Italiana, after all. But they seemed to understand. Gabrielle nodded. She was holding her son's hand, and they were conferring quietly. The boy didn't want to jump anymore. He was understandably afraid that he or his mother would be picked off by the German watch.
"Climb down this side and make your way to the couplings between cars, where you won't be easily seen.
It will also give you the opportunity to turn around and jump outward. Cover your head and roll when you hit the ground. Then stay down. Stay flat. Don't start running until the train is passed. And then wait a bit so the man on the caboose doesn't see you and shoot.
Gabrielle told her son.
How do you know this?
Eva asked.
Gabrielle shook her head. I don't. It is just what makes sense to me. I've thought about it non-stop since the first train.
Do you know where we are?
We're in Switzerland, I think. But we may have already crossed into Germany. We need to jump soon. Otherwise, we will be deep into Germany. The deeper, the worse off we'll be.
I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. It is too risky.
Pierre cried.
Where will you go?
Eva interrupted. The woman soothed her son and answered softly.
We are Belgian. We are going to try to get back home. The Germans are pulling back. We think it will be safe if we can just get home. We fled to France when Hitler invaded.
What happened?
The Italian army left. They were actually the reason we stayed safe so long. And the Germans moved into the sector the Italians had once controlled. People were rounded up. My husband was detained and deported. Pierre and I stayed hidden for 5 more months. But in February we were discovered. We were put on a train for the transit camp. And we've been waiting there ever since for a group large enough to transport.
Please, Maman, we don't have to do this. We are strong. We will be all right in a camp.
Pierre pleaded with his mother.
No, Pierre, it is our only chance to go home.
Gabrielle said firmly, holding his gaze.
You have to jump, and you will jump, just like we planned. And you will get to Belgium. You will live, Pierre.
He nodded, but his eyes filled with tears that spilled down his cheeks. He embraced his mother fiercely. And she kissed his cheeks and held him for a brief moment before pushing him toward the window. He climbed up obediently. No one protested this time. No one tried to make him feel guilty or responsible. They just watched morosely. Pierre was much smaller than Armand, but maneuvering to get his legs out the small opening first, balancing on the lip of the window, was a feat in itself. He waited. Watching for the light. When it swept past, he slid out the window. He didn't hesitate or look back, and with just a brief snag, his shoulders cleared and his head disappeared over the side. They could see his fingertips clinging. Then they were gone, too. There were no accompanying shots. Gabrielle prayed and wept vocally. Then she turned to Eva.
Now it's your turn. Gabrielle, you have to go. Pierre is waiting for you,
Eva urged.
He made it. He must have.
I can't do it. I'm not strong enough or agile enough to survive it.
I know it, and Pierre knows it. It is why he didn't want to jump. You have to try. Your son will be frantic.
You go,
Gabrielle insisted again.
You jump, and stay with my boy. Help him get home.
Eva could only shake her head.
No, you can't do that to him.
I had no choice. I want him to live.
She pushed Eva toward the window.
We have to hurry. The train is moving quickly. You won't be able to find him. The distance grows every second we delay.
But,
Eva protested, thinking of the boy in the dark, waiting for his mother. Gabrielle turned on her with fierce eyes, her fingers cutting into Eva's arm.
S'il vous plaît, please. I've done what I can to save him. Please help me. Save yourself and help my son.
I will help you up,
someone offered, tugging on Eva's sleeve. It was a middle-aged man with a small child and a wife heavy with pregnancy. They wouldn't be jumping. Eva hesitated once more.
Go,
Gabrielle said. And Eva could only nod helplessly as the desperate mother imparted instructions in an urgent whisper.
Go to my husband's aunt in Bastogne. She will take you and Pierre. She will keep you safe until the war is over. Tell Pierre I love him, and I am proud of him. I will fight, and I will live, and we will be together again, all of us, someday.
The man who'd offered to help Eva linked his fingers together and braced his feet, creating a step. Eva put her foot in his hands, and he bent his knees and launched her upward, giving her the lift and momentum needed to grasp the lip of the little window with one hand and the remaining bar with the other. She didn't wait for courage or even to see if she was clear to go. She went out the window head first, just like in her dream. She was still clinging to the bar with her left hand, and the action swung her around, her legs pinwheeling for purchase, a shriek on her lips. She hung from the bar for an eternal second before her toes found the edge of the cattle car. A shot rang out, and then another, whizzing above her head. With all her might, Eva let go and pushed away from the train with the balls of her feet, turning as she flew, weightless for a heartbeat, contorting herself like a circus performer.
"Slide into home," Angelo had said when they played baseball. "Slide, Eva! Slide!"
She slid through the air, parallel with the ground, flying toward home base. Then she was tumbling and bending, end over end, head, buttocks, hands, back, side, knees, shoulders, stomach, back. Like a rug being beaten against the cobblestones, flapping and connecting, flapping and connecting. And then she was still, lying on her back, staring up at a sky filled with dazzling stars. There was no air in her lungs, and she fought to inhale, unable to reinflate her diaphragm fast enough. But she'd done it. She imagined Angelo throwing his arms out to the sides and yelling, "Safe!" the way he used to do when she slid home, just like he'd taught her. She smiled as she gasped and choked, sitting up to reach for a breath, ignoring Gabrielle's second set of instructions along with the first. She'd said, "Stay down until the train is gone." Eva hadn't even checked, but the train was slowly disappearing, just a black rectangle in the distance, growing smaller and smaller, quieter and quieter as she watched. She wanted to lie back down and enjoy her home run for a minute more. She was starting to feel the raw scrape of her tumble, and she knew she would be bruised and sore. But for the first time since Angelo had been dragged from Via Tasso, she felt a glimmer of life, a spark. She wouldn't think about tomorrow. She wouldn't think about how alone she was. She would just celebrate the victory of escape, of survival, and that was all.
"Mama! Mama!"
she heard Pierre, calling and running toward her. He'd probably been running since he jumped, racing after the train, watching for his mother. Eva rose gingerly to her feet, swaying as the confused blood in her body reoriented itself. It was dark, and Pierre was still a distance off. He was not yet aware it was she, not Gabrielle, who waited for him. She started to walk back toward him, dreading the moment he realized it was her. She felt a sick flash of sympathy when he pulled up short.
"Where is my mother?"
he gasped, out of breath from sprinting along the tracks, running after a train that had carried his maman away.
"She didn't jump, Pierre. I'm so sorry."
"Maman!"
he called, panicked, and began running once more, racing across uneven ground, tripping and staggering, calling for his mother. Eva pressed her hands against her aching heart and followed him. She didn't know what else to do. She didn't want to take away his hope. She didn't want to discourage him, but she knew Gabrielle hadn't jumped. She'd loved her son enough to part with him if it could save his life. But Eva understood when Pierre sat down and buried his head in his hands. She understood his desolation. Life was small comfort when you had to live it alone.
"What if she decides to jump, and I've given up?"
he mourned.
"We can wait here for a while. If she jumped, she will walk back this way,"
Eva suggested.
"What if she jumped and she's hurt, lying down there somewhere beside the tracks?"
He sounded so young and lost.
"We will listen to see if she calls to you,"
she soothed softly. He nodded despondently, and they waited, side by side, for a call that didn't come. Finally, Eva could bear the silence no longer. She was cold and sore, and there were trees in every direction. She had no idea which way to start walking.
"Pierre, do you recognize any of this? Do you have any idea where we might be?"
she asked gently.
"It is north to Bergen-Belsen. Maman told me the tracks lead north."
He pointed in the direction the train had just gone, then pointed straight in front of him.
"We were going to go west. West is Belgium. That was our plan." "There is nothing for me at home,"
Eva said. There was nothing for her anywhere, but she pushed the thought out of her mind. She would grieve later. Now she had to survive.
"I will go with you to Belgium. Your mother says you have an aunt in Bastogne. She said she would come for you there when the war is over."
The boy nodded and brightened a little, slightly reassured that he wasn't completely alone in the world.
"I hope we are still in Switzerland,"
he mused.
"If we are, we will be fine. We can go anywhere and ask for help and directions. But first we need to figure out where we are. The sun is coming up. I'm going to climb a tree and see what's beyond the forest. We can always walk south along the tracks if I can't see anything. Maman said the tracks will lead to a town."
His mother had prepared him to be alone. It was obvious. Eva nodded and waited for him to scramble up a nearby tree. It wasn't long before he was calling down to her excitedly.
"There is a road! I see a road! We will walk to it and see if there are any signs so we can figure out where we are."
Pierre had climbed another tree before they finally emerged from the forest and came upon the road. But they were in luck. It was a sign, but their luck was short-lived. The sign said, "Frankfurt, 10 kilometers. They were in Germany. 28 March, 1944. Confession. I've broken my vows, and I feel no remorse. Eva told me once there were two things she knew for sure. One was that no one knows the nature of God. No one. And the other thing she knew for sure was that she loved me. I find I am reduced to those same assurances. I love Eva. I will always love Eva. And as for the rest, I only know that I know nothing at all. Many will seek to tell me what God's will is, but nobody knows. Not really. Because God is quiet. Always. He is quiet, and my anguish is so intense, so incredibly loud, that right now I can only do my will and hope that somehow it aligns with his. Angelo Bianco.
Chapter 23. Crossroads. The blank pages in Eva's journal haunted Angelo. She'd been snatched up, whisked away, stolen. She'd been taken from him and her story wasn't finished. He wouldn't let it be. So he would keep writing until she could pick up where she left off. He recorded his first entry the day he returned to the Vatican on crutches, dressed as a civilian, looking every bit like a man who had narrowly escaped death multiple times. He'd been hustled into Monsignor O'Flaherty's office, and Monsignor Luciano was called as well.
"You look like you've been through hell,"
Monsignor O'Flaherty said, tipping Angelo's chin up so he could stare into his badly bruised face.
"More than 300 men were pulled from the prisons and off the streets. No one knows what happened to them. Then we got word that you were alive. Beaten, but alive. What happened to you? Where did they take you? And where are the other men?
Everyone is dead, Angelo whispered.
Dear God,
O'Flaherty gasped.
Where?
Monsignor Luciano cried.
They took us to the Fosse Ardeatine. They took the men into the cave, five at a time, and killed them with a shot to the back of the head, one after the other. Toward the end, one of the German soldiers sneaked me out through another tunnel. He saved my life. He took other lives, but he saved mine. He didn't want to kill a priest.
Angelo stopped, the weight of the memory suddenly more than he could carry.
The soldiers didn't want to do it. Lieutenant Colonel Kepler sent cases of cognac to the caves to loosen them up so they could perform.
His voice was bitter, and the horror continued to rise in him like a tidal wave. He closed his eyes and focused on breathing, focused on the here and now, on Monsignor O'Flaherty's hand on his shoulder.
"It is a miracle that you are alive,"
Monsignor Luciano whispered.
"Praise God."
"I am grateful for my life, Monsignor,"
Angelo said softly.
"But it is very hard for me to praise God in this moment. I lived, but 335 others did not. I feel more guilt than anything. I lived, hundreds died, and Eva is gone."
"I have tried to discover where the train was headed, Angelo. All I know is that Eva was on it,"
Monsignor O'Flaherty offered after a short silence. "She is young, and she is strong," Monsignor Luciano said, trying to comfort him. "She will be all right."
Angelo bit back a curse. Monsignor Luciano could be incredibly blind and stupid sometimes.
"You can't come back to the apartment, Angelo. You will stay here at the Vatican until Rome is liberated,"
Luciano continued, as if the matter were resolved.
"I will continue on until Rome is liberated, until the people I am responsible for no longer have to hide,"
he agreed softly.
"And then?"
Monsignor O'Flaherty asked, clearly sensing there was more.
"I no longer want to be a priest. I have broken my vows," he said with finality.
He'd broken them willingly, intentionally. Angelo had taken a vow of obedience, and he'd been anything but obedient. He'd taken a vow of celibacy, and he'd made love to Eva. The only vow he'd kept was that of poverty. But maybe he'd broken that one, too. He'd been greedy for time with Eva, greedy for her touch, her kisses, her love. She'd offered them time and time again, and he'd resisted her, rejected her, refused her. Until the day he hadn't. And he'd taken her love and her kisses and her touch, and she'd made him a wealthy man, rich in love and promise and possibility. And he'd only wanted more, more, more. That was what haunted him. He could have had a lifetime with her, and he'd squandered it. He didn't feel remorse that he'd broken his vows. He was remorseful that he hadn't broken them sooner. He should never have made them in the first place. When he told the Monsignors how he felt, Monsignor O'Flaherty quietly listened. But Monsignor Luciano grew angry.
"You have broken your vows, but you have been ordained. Sin can be forgiven. You don't just stop being a priest because you sin. You have been ordained, indelibly changed, and you can't be unordained. You know this. You are God's. You don't belong to yourself anymore, Angelo. You don't belong to Eva. You are God's,"
Monsignor Luciano repeated emphatically, thumping his chest as if God himself resided beneath the cloth of his robes.
"I am Eva's,"
Angelo said quietly.
"In my heart, I am Eva's." "But she is gone,"
Monsignor Luciano shouted.
"She is not gone. She is still here,"
Angelo cried, and it was his turn to thump his chest. She is still here inside me, and I am still hers. I will always be hers.
Does loving Eva mean you can't love God? Monsignor Luciano said after a long silence. His anger was gone, his voice subdued, his face haggard. But Angelo was committed to answering honestly, even if it hurt his old mentor.
No, but I would ask you the same thing. Can I only serve him if I'm a priest, if I'm Catholic?
I don't believe that anymore, Monsignor. I've seen too much.
I want to do the right things for the right reasons. Not because someone will judge or someone else will wonder. Not because of tradition or pressure. Not because I'm afraid or embarrassed to do anything else. And not because it's what people expect. I want to do his will. But that is what I struggle with most. Knowing what his will really is. Not his will according to the Catholic Church, but his will.
We need you, Angelo. Rome needs you. The refugees need you. This church needs you,
Monsignor O'Flaherty said. Angelo could only shake his head.
I have put Eva last for too long. She needs me. She needs me to love her enough not to give up on her.
Tell me this. Is it that you don't want to be a priest? Or is it that you want Eva more? Monsignor O'Flaherty asked.
I want Eva more, Angelo said honestly. And if Eva doesn't survive, what then?
Monsignor Luciano asked.
I can't think that way, Monsignor.
I won't.
I'm not asking you to give up. I'm asking you to continue on in your duties. You are a priest. That has not changed. And if Eva survives, if she returns to you, then we can talk about leaving the clerical life, about laicization,
Monsignor Luciano coaxed.
I'm not going to wait for her to come back. I'm going to find her,
Angelo said.
You can't simply shrug off your ordination, Angelo. You know this. It is permanent,
Monsignor Luciano declared with finality. Angelo ran shaking hands through his hair, despair and fatigue bowing his back and fraying his nerves.
Then I am absolved, he asked wearily.
You are not repentant, Monsignor Luciano barked. Angelo searched his heart. Was he repentant? No, he wasn't.
I seek your forgiveness, both of you, for disappointing you. For not being who you want me to be. But I am not sorry for the way I feel, or for my actions.
Then you are not absolved, Monsignor Luciano shot back.
You are not absolved,
Monsignor O'Flaherty concurred softly. But you can continue with your duties.
I forgive you, wholeheartedly. And I can attest that if you ask, God will forgive you as well. He understands, Angelo. You know that he does. You feel it. He is giving you his peace.
Monsignor O'Flaherty's loving forgiveness, spoken in the soft burr of his Irish accent, had Angelo fighting back tears of exhausted surrender. His anger and rebellion left him suddenly, and he fought to remain upright. He was so tired. So incredibly tired.
We have a room prepared for you. It isn't much, but you need to rest. Tomorrow will come soon enough. We need supplies. Without Eva's gold, we are low on resources.
O'Flaherty sighed. Angelo reached for his makeshift knapsack and opened it, upending it on the thick rug, revealing what was inside. It was full of gold. Chains, bracelets, trinkets, tie pins, and rings.
The Saturday Eva played at the gala, she took her empty violin case to work, and she filled it to the brim with gold. When she went home to dress for the event, she emptied her case and gave the gold to Mother Francesca.
She was worried something would happen that night, and she wouldn't be able to take any more. She was right. Something did happen. She was recognized. It wasn't a question. O'Flaherty had heard this part of the story through his own channels. Yes, the wife of Rome's chief of police told Greta von Essen that Eva was an accomplished violinist from Florence. A Jew. The captain's wife then told her husband. She could have stayed quiet. She was Eva's friend, and she betrayed her. Yes, she did. But maybe she will be able to redeem herself. She is a Catholic, quite devout, unlike her husband. She goes to Mass at church on Via Rasella. She was there when the bomb set by the partisans killed the German police. Monsignor O'Flaherty stopped and rubbed at his jaw, thinking. Father Bartolo is her pastor. He told me she's been there every day for the last 2 weeks. Maybe she can help you with the answers you need. Eva stared at the road sign in horrified silence until Pierre spoke up, falsely cheerful.
It could be worse. I actually know where we are. Bastogne is directly west of Frankfurt, Pierre offered. Almost a straight path that way.
He pointed at the road that intersected the highway they stood beside. There wasn't a soul in sight, which was both encouraging and frightening. The sky was lightening with the coming dawn, and they had nowhere to hide and no place to go, with only the clothes on their backs and the slim gold file Eva had tucked back in her shoe.
How far?
Eva was trying to remember her geography and failing miserably. She was comforted that Pierre seemed to know his.
Not far at all, by train. Papa used to go to Frankfurt on business all the time. Germans make the best toys. He would always bring me something back. How far, Pierre?
He was clearly stalling.
About 250 kilometers,
Pierre said quietly. 250 kilometers. More than 150 miles across German-occupied territory.
And how far is Switzerland? Do you know that?
He shook his head.
No, not exactly, but it's just as far, if not farther.
Eva sank down beside the road and laid her head on her knees. Pierre sat down beside her, and neither could find the energy for further conversation. They watched in silent despondence as the sun rose in the east, breaking out in hopeful radiance above the tree line.
Angelo,
Eva whispered, watching the spread of light that defied her heavy heart. The beauty made her long for him.
What should I do? What would you do? Who are you talking to?
Pierre asked softly. She had spoken in Italian, a language he didn't speak.
This guy, I guess. That is where all my loved ones are.
He nodded as if he understood.
What is your name?
He asked suddenly. Eva laughed, just a brief huff of incredulity. The poor boy didn't even know her name. She was a complete stranger, and she was all he had.
Eva Rosselli.
She stuck out her hand, and he clasped it in his, shaking it firmly. His fingers were as cold as hers.
Pierre Lamont?
He added his surname to the name she already knew.
Pierre Lamont?
That's not a very Jewish name.
No, my father wasn't Jewish, just my mother, but they took my father anyway. I see you trembling there. How much it cost you, loving me. How much it cost you, loving me. They took my father too,
Eva said, ignoring the haunting lyric that played in her head. Love often had a terrible cost.
Was he the one you were talking to?
Pierre didn't seem to find it strange that she was conversing with the sky.
No, I was talking to Angelo. Who is Angelo? Angelo was the man I wanted to marry. I love him very much. What did Angelo say?
Pierre asked seriously, as if her response were entirely plausible. It made a lump rise in her throat and tears brim in her eyes.
"He didn't answer," she said, her voice choked. "What do you think he would say, if he could?" "He would tell me to pray. If Angelo were here, he would pray," she supplied immediately. "We can do that. And then what?" "If Angelo were here..."
Eva thought for a moment, and then the answer came as clearly as if a voice had spoken directly in her
ear. "If Angelo were here, he would tell me to find a
church." Pierre rose to his feet and held out his hand. She let him pull her up, and she brushed at her backside, as if the little bit of dirt and debris she'd gathered sitting at the side of the road could make her filthy skirt look any worse. Pierre walked ahead to the crossroads and turned west.
"Eva, look!"
Pierre stopped walking and pointed.
"There! Can you see it?"
She hurried to his side and gazed in amazement. He was pointing at a thin white steeple rising above a small cluster of picturesque houses in the distance.
"Merci, Angelo,"
Pierre said simply.
"Merci, Angelo,"
Eva whispered.
"Now let us find a priest just like you."
She was a pretty woman, tall and voluptuous, easily as tall as her husband. But for all her Amazonian beauty, Greta von Essen was as timid and as frightened as a mouse. Angelo had watched her walk into the church, genuflect before the cross and light a candle. He'd watched her briefly pray and then walk to the confessional, where she'd stayed for several minutes before walking out again and heading for the large doors at the back of the church. That is where he cut her off, standing directly in her path. He wasn't wearing his cassock. He wore his work clothes and an old cap, and she glanced at him nervously. She looked away, but her eyes returned almost immediately. She tipped her head to the side, narrowing her eyes and pursing her lips, as if she couldn't place him. He saw the moment she realized who he was. She turned and started walking swiftly in the other direction, toward an exit just left of the apse. Angelo felt a flash of fury, and without thinking he was pursuing her, almost running, loping awkwardly to overtake her.
"Stop," he ordered as she picked up speed. "I only want to talk to you. You owe me that much."
She stopped abruptly, as if following orders was second nature. She turned slowly and eyed him with trepidation.
"My husband said you were dead."
Her voice was accusing, as if the fact that he wasn't was somehow dishonest on his part.
"I should be. Did he tell you how I supposedly died?"
She shook her head.
"He wouldn't. It wouldn't make you love or admire him, I promise you that. Did he tell you what happened to Eva?"
She nodded sharply and looked down at the pocketbook in her hands. She was shaking.
"Tell me."
He lowered his voice and strove to use a lighter tone.
"She was deported."
"Where to?"
"I don't know."
"You didn't care enough to ask."
His voice was gentle, but she still flinched.
"She lied to me."
"How? How did she lie?"
"She didn't tell me she was Jewish."
"That's because you couldn't handle the truth."
"Clearly. Look what happened to Eva, to me, when you found out." "She told me you were her brother."
Another accusation that had nothing to do with Greta, but one she had undoubtedly used to rationalize what she'd done.
"I'm not her brother."
"So she told two lies."
"Your husband is a murdering bastard, and you are worried about lies told to preserve life."
He fought to keep his voice level.
"Are you even a priest?"
she asked, her voice dripping with scorn.
"Yes."
"Not a very good one,"
she retorted fiercely.
"No, not a very good one.
though I've always done the best I could, he said honestly, and realized suddenly that it was true. He'd always done his best with the strength and resources he had. My husband said you were in love with Eva. Again, derision, as if his love were incredibly distasteful. I am in love with her. I have always loved her. And I'm going to find her. He held her gaze, unwavering, unapologetic. I knew there was someone. You are the boy from home. The one she wouldn't talk about. He nodded once, and she deflated before his eyes. When she looked at him again, there was no more defensiveness, no more contempt. There was only remorse.
I didn't want to tell Wilhelm. I cared about Eva. But I knew if he discovered it some other way, if he found out I knew, he would hurt me. Frau Caruso knew, and it was only a matter of time before she talked to others. The secret was just too good. Too rich.
I need to find out where Eva was taken. Can you find out?
I don't know, she whispered, shaking her head.
She seemed to fall back to helplessness when she was scared, and he guessed Greta von Essen was scared most of the time.
Find out where she was taken, and we will do our best to get you out of Rome if you need help doing so. You need to go home, signora.
This brought her head up.
Why? Aren't the Germans winning? The Americans have been defeated at Anzio Beach, haven't they?
Angelo shook his head. He knew it was only a matter of time. God would not be quiet forever.
They've been stalled. But America has the firepower, the manpower, and most important, they have the right on their side. The kind of evil I have seen has to be stopped. This war isn't about two equal but opposing forces who disagree. This war is about right and wrong, good and evil must be stopped. It will be stopped. And people like you will be caught in a crossfire when that happens.
If I find out where she was sent, how will I get word to you?
She said quietly, not even arguing about good and evil, right and wrong. She had to know on some level. She had to.
Tell Father Bartolo. He will tell me. 10 May, 1944. Confession. I don't know what to do. Eva's been sent to Bergen-Belsen. I felt immediate relief that it wasn't Auschwitz, and then I realized I didn't even know where Bergen-Belsen was. Greta von Essen came through with the information. Father Bartolo said she was sure that she'd seen the transport records. I don't know how she accomplished that, but I couldn't ask. A few days ago, Greta von Essen left Rome in the company of a group of nuns returning to Germany from an Easter pilgrimage to the Vatican. Monsignor O'Flaherty arranged it. Northern Germany. Bergen-Belsen. I have a destination. But it might as well be the moon. The German police in Rome are growing more vicious and desperate as the days go by. A surprise raid on a monastery in the San Lorenzo district of Rome has resulted in the arrest and seizure of 3 monks and 12 foreign Jews. One boy tried to escape and was gunned down in front of his parents, who at that point threw themselves on his inert form and were shot as well. The monks were imprisoned, along with the rest of the captured refugees. We were tipped off by a local fascist official that a raid would be carried out at an abandoned villa south of Rome, where 50 Jewish orphans had been hidden and watched over by an order of Capuchin monks. We beat the raid by an hour, scattering the children among village homes until the Germans left. When they did, we returned the children to the villa and to the care of the monks. We are all praying the Germans don't go back. It is a game of cat and mouse, priest and prey, and it's a wonder more aren't breaking under the stress. But we have a purpose, and none of us thinks beyond the moment, beyond the day. We scramble and pray and sleep when we can.
Temperatures are warming, and people in the southernmost parts of the city, near the catacombs in the caves of Ardeatine, are starting to complain about a smell. The dead are making themselves known. The anger and fear in the city, the desperation of the occupying forces, and the tick-tock of the end seem to permeate the air with the same stench of death. None of us will be able to hold on much longer. But for Eva's sake, I will. And wherever she is, she just has to hold on, too. Angelo Bianco.
Chapter 24. The Americans. When members of the America's Fifth Army finally captured Rome on June 4, 1944, there was very little fanfare. The Germans simply left. The long red banners and the Nazi flags were removed from the headquarters on Via Tasso. The homes they'd requisitioned were vacated. The political prisoners were abandoned. They simply retreated. Some said it was the Pope's influence. Some said it was a strategic regrouping. A few said it was respect for Rome's considerable historic and artistic significance. But whatever the reason, when the time came, they left. Then the people waited with breaths held, ears peeled. The American planes had dropped leaflets the day before, urging civilians to stay indoors, to stay out of the way in case the conflict grew heated. But there was no fighting, no bombing, just the quiet fall of leaflets and the dawn of a clear June morning. When the first American trucks and tanks rolled into town, people didn't stay inside. They danced in the streets. It was a strange sight, really. Italians, who had allied themselves with a ruthless dictator and fought and died beside Germany's sons, were welcoming the Americans into their capital city. When German tanks and troops had descended on Rome a mere 9 months before, people had died trying to keep them out. It said a great deal about the feelings of the Italian people, about their resentment for being drafted into a war very few of them wanted, made to fight and die for preposterous goals and ridiculous men. Angelo could only watch with bittersweet relief as the parade of military vehicles clattered along cobblestone roads and people wept with jubilation. Mario and his little family, the nuns of Santa Cecilia, and even Monsignor Luciano and his sister stood and greeted the American troops, who were smiling and waving like movie stars as they rolled into the city. For Rome, the war was over. For the clergy, for the resistance, and for the Jews in hiding, this day was a staggering victory. They had survived. Most of them. But some had not. Some still would not. The war was not over for those who'd been taken. It was not over for Eva and for the numberless Jews still imprisoned in camps in the north and in the east. It was not over for the Allied soldiers who would fight on, pushing the Germans into further retreat. 2 days later, on June 6th, Angelo and a small group of priests at the Vatican gathered around a radio as the BBC declared that D-Day had come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress, the announcer reported. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies on the northern coast of France. Throughout the following days, countries aligned against Hitler waited with nervous hearts and shaking hands, listening for updates and reports. The Germans only suffered 1,000 casualties that first day. The Allies suffered 10 times that. But by June 12th, all 5 of the beachheads of Normandy were linked and in Allied control, giving them the foothold they needed to run Germany out of France. From Normandy, Paris was a straight shot east, and when Paris was liberated in late August, Angelo implemented the only plan he'd been able to devise. A soldier with the Fifth Army, a major who'd spent the last year in Italy, had given him some advice.
The fifth is being split up. Some of us are being sent into France. The war in Italy is going nowhere, Father. We've been here for too damn long, fighting our way up one hill only to face another right behind it. We've taken Rome, but if things continue as they have for the last 9 months, it's going to continue to be a slog, and we sure as hell won't be getting out of Italy until Germany surrenders or we do. It's a battle of inches here. If you want to get to this girl, your best bet is to get into France and follow the Americans into Germany from that direction.
Angelo told Monsignor O'Flaherty his decision and was given his blessing, along with a reminder that he was still a priest. He had not been laicized. He would not be given permission to marry. That kind of permission had to come from the Pope himself, and it was never granted. If he wanted to marry Eva, he would have to do so outside of the Catholic Church. But Monsignor O'Flaherty embraced him anyway and told him that when he found Eva, he should bring her back to Rome so he could see her again. The American army had moved into the Hassler Hotel, known by locals as the Villa Medici, making the newly renovated site their headquarters for the duration of their stay. Angelo found himself there, dressed in his cassock, his cane tucked out of sight, waiting to speak with the commander of the Fifth Army who had taken the city 2 months before. He had taken the major's advice. He was there to enlist in whatever capacity they needed him. His only goal was to get to Germany. The hotel was filled with memories of Eva, even though in its current state it looked nothing like it had the night Eva played her violin for a room full of the enemy. He could see her so clearly, resplendent in her black gown, her slim neck bowed over her instrument, a sparkle at her ears and a gleam in her eyes as she looked at him. He'd held one of those earrings in the palm of his hand that night as he'd contemplated the future, leaning over the sink in her hotel room, warm from the bath and cold from the evening's events. His nerves had been shot from the raid, his emotions running high. He had felt the shift, the realignment of his priorities, and as he held the earring in his hand, Eva sleeping in the next room, he had been heart-sick with love and soul-weary with waiting.
"Father, what can I do for you?"
A trim man in a neat uniform with slicked-back hair and a cigarette clenched in his teeth waved him forward from his office door. His office was the large coat room where Eva had told Angelo about the suspected raid. Angelo stood and followed the commander inside, trying not to reveal his limp, and probably making it more noticeable for his efforts. He decided to get right to the point, and after sitting down across from the commander, jumped right in. "I've come to see if it would be possible to be of service to your men."
"We have chaplains, Father, but we could always use a few more. Is that what you mean?"
"I've lived in Italy since I was 11 years old, but I'm an American. I speak fluent German and Italian and passable French. I could be an interpreter as well as a chaplain."
"Why? The army doesn't pay well, and you don't have to do this."
"I do have to do this. Plus, the priesthood doesn't pay well either. That isn't why most of us do what we do, is it, Commander?"
"You got that right, Padre. But what are your reasons?"
"A Jewish girl, a girl who is very important to me, was deported and sent to a concentration camp in northern Germany almost 5 months ago. I intend to find her. I was told the best way to do that would be to follow the American army into Germany. I will serve in any capacity you wish, just as long as you'll send me where I have the best chance of getting to Germany the quickest."
"You'll have to stay for the duration, even if you, by some miracle, find this girl. You'll have to see it through to the end. You won't be able to quit."
"I understand. My only goal is to find her and get her to safety. I will fulfill my commitments."
"Father O'Flaherty said you were determined."
Angelo stared at the mention of the Monsignor.
"He sent me a message. Said you'd be coming to see me. He managed to hide several of our downed pilots from the Germans. We owe him. He told me I could repay him by helping you."
Angelo could only nod, humbled by the gesture,
Leave it to O'Flaherty to do whatever he could.
What's with the leg? You limp.
It's a childhood ailment. I cannot walk everyone I know. I always carry my own weight, Commander. You won't need to worry about me.
The commander laughed and sat forward in his chair.
I believe you, Father. Sounds to me like you have a guardian angel on your shoulder. Monsignor O'Flaherty told me about the massacre at Ardeatine. That won't go unpunished. I promise you that.
Many good men were murdered that day,
Angelo said softly.
Many good men have been lost in this damn war. It's what keeps me going. I'll do my best to help you find that girl. But I'm warning you, it's going to be a long, hard road yet. The Germans aren't done fighting, and as long as they're still kicking, we have to fight too.
I don't know what else I can do. I can't simply take a train into Germany and demand her release. But I can't sit here either. I have to go. The only thing keeping me standing is the belief that she is there. And if I can just get to her in time, if she can hold on until I get to her, then that's what I'm going to do.
The commander took a deep drag off his cigarette and released the smoke slowly as he eyed Angelo. Then he nodded, as if he'd made up his mind and was at ease with his decision.
We have an army transport leaving for France in 3 days. You'll be on it. We'll find enough work to keep you busy, and you'll probably wish you'd never signed on. The 20th Armored Division just arrived in the south of France. They'll be working their way up quickly to the border between France and Germany. That's the best I can do for you, Father. Godspeed.
I'm coming with you, Mario said firmly. Mario, no. No, you aren't.
Angelo had walked down the steps of St. Peter's Basilica to see Mario waiting just beyond the gates, an army duffel bag on his back and determination in his eyes.
I'm a doctor. They will take me. I don't speak very good English, but you do. You're an American, after all. Together we can do this. I'm a doctor, you're a medic. A spiritual medic. God's medic.
He smiled and shrugged.
Ah, yes, I am saving souls right and left, Angelo said with a self-deprecating smile.
His duties the last few months had been of the temporal nature. Food, shelter, safety. He hadn't performed any of the more sacred rites because he felt unworthy to do so, committed as he was to leaving the priesthood behind if he found Eva.
I am coming with you, Mario repeated. Mario, you have a wife and 3 children who have been through hell. You are finally free to resume your lives. They need you. You have to think of them.
Julia agrees with me. She and the children will stay at the convent, and I will send them my stipend every month. They are safe, and Julia has help. I'm not a soldier. I won't be fighting. I will be saving lives and getting paid to do it. And if that fails, I'll join the Red Cross. I have spent the war hiding while my people were being slaughtered. This is my way of making a difference. Of fighting back. I don't have a job.
You could find one. If something happened to you, Mario, I would never forgive myself. The world can't afford to lose any more Jewish men. The world can't afford to lose a man like you, period.
Don't make me carry that weight,
Angelo interrupted.
If I don't come with you, I won't ever forgive myself. Eva Rosselli sat with her back to my door, her legs braced against the wall while the Gestapo shot through it. She single-handedly saved my entire family. And she has been taken. Signora Donati, my neighbor, faced down men with machine guns to inform them that my apartment was empty, that no one lived there anymore. She was taken too. I've watched you put your life at risk over and over. I've watched you scramble and maneuver and work to keep hundreds of Jews safe. You were beaten and sent to die, and you could have talked. You could have exposed us, but you didn't.
I have been forced to let all of you sacrifice for me and my family. I had to, but not anymore. It's my turn. I intend to be there when those camps are liberated. It's my turn to save lives.
I'm coming with you, Angelo. And you can't stop me.
13 December 1944. Confession. I couldn't part with Eva's violin. I have walked through France with a violin case on my